You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 510. If you're going through hell, keep going. Winston Churchill.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, before we get started, guys, I wanted to give you an update on that big, big project I've been working on. And many of you have already seen this project because we have a brand new indiefilmhustle.com. It is Indie Film Hustle 3.0. It has been rebuilt from the ground up. It is easier to navigate. It is cleaner. It is more precise. There's a bunch of new cool things that I've incorporated in it. I have been working feverishly trying to rebuild this website. I think it was a time for a little bit of a rebuild, and I hope it is easier for you to navigate and can find more value out of it. So if you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com. And we have a whole new section of free courses that you can take, free webinars, specific higher end education that is not accessible on YouTube or anywhere else, but you can sign up and enroll and reserve your spot for those webinars as well. So again, check out the new Indie Film Hustle at indiefilmhustle.com. Now, guys, today we're going to talk about something that affects so many, not only people around the world, but filmmakers and screenwriters as well. Creatives in general, we all deal with moments of depression and loss of hope and just not being able to get through to the next stage in our lives. And depression's a serious thing. I've gone through it in my career many times as a filmmaker. I don't think there is a filmmaker alive who hasn't been depressed at one point or another. It is just part of the process. But I wanted to bring on a guest. His name is Lucas McNally, and he's dealt with depression and as a filmmaker and the kind of almost paralyzing depression that he had and how he broke through it. And I hope that this conversation helps filmmakers and screenwriters around the world know that even if you are in hell, like Winston Churchill said, you got to keep going and go through it. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Lucas McNally. I'd like to welcome the show, Lucas McNally. How you doing, Lucas?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I read an article in Movie Maker about how you spent better part of a decade trying to get a movie finished, and we're going to definitely get into the weeds about
the insanity of that, because we're all insane because we're filmmakers, because that's sure. just comes along with the with the package. But before we even get to that part, how did you get started in the business? What made you get into this insanity?
Yeah, well, because I didn't know any better. So I was not into film like at all when I was a kid. Like I was into sports. I was a big basketball, baseball person. Mm-hmm. And I was going to do sports broadcasting and, you know, be the next Bob Costas. Sure. So and then in college, my senior year of college, the student activities or whoever said, hey, we're going to try to do a film festival this year. And I thought, well, that'll be fun. Let's try that. And so me and a buddy of mine just decided to make a film. And I'm like, how hard could it be? And turns out it's very hard. And like, I didn't know how to use the camera. Like right. I shot most of it. And like the very first day, I'm like, how do you even turn this thing on? Like couldn't get it on the tripod. And then we ended up winning the thing.
Nice.
So from that point, I was like, well, this is a lot of fun. Kind of got hooked on it.
And then of course, a downward spiral ever since.
Yeah, and that is where all the blame lies.
That was the peak.
Sure.
The one award. Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I got my award.
I haven't won anything since, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You get that one award at a film festival, and you're like, I think I can go with this. And then you're just like, wait a minute, it's not that easy anymore.
There's a lot of beginner's luck, I think.
Good timing. So then tell me, man, tell me about Upcountry, man, your film Upcountry.
Sure.
The journey of it, why it took 10 years to make, how did you keep, there's so many questions. So tell me how it got started in the first place.
Well, depression is a hell of a drug. So that's the short version of it. The long version is, I was living in Pennsylvania for a while, and then I ended up, after a breakup, I was back in Maine, and I kind of needed to do something. So I was like, well, we have this hunting camp in the woods and crowdfunding had just started. And I was like, well, I'll crowdfund a movie and we'll shoot a movie. And so that was the easy part. We crowdfunded $4,000 and I got people from around the country to come up. Basically the $4,000 was for plane tickets and food. And we shot it in a week. We shot 7 days in the woods, sun up to sundown, trek out into the woods, and you know, just shoot all day. And then I cut it and everything was sort of going to plan. I did A Year Without Rent after that, and I finished editing it to picture lock on A Year Without Rent. And then we were sort of chipping away at the sound mix, and it's, you know, it's a $4,000 film, so it's when people have time to do it,
right?
And then we were in a festival in, I want to say 2012 or 2013, and we got bumped. And I was literally getting plane tickets to go to Philly to sound mix it and to, like, you know, do like 4 hard days of sound mixing. And it got bumped, and I was like, well, I guess we don't necessarily need to do this right now. And the sound editor is like, well, I can have this paid gig, so do you want to just push it a couple weeks? And a couple weeks became a couple more weeks, and then it was sort of, we chip away at it over email, and it just sort of got away from me, you know. It's like that thing that just sort of becomes, you know, the gaps become longer in trying to get the thing done, and without that fire of the thing, and it just sort of like snowballed on me. And before I knew it, it was like 2 years had passed. And
so
I was,
you
mean, like,
so you had shot, so this is not a film you shot over 10 years. You had shot the
film.
No,
I shot the film.
In the can. It was in the can.
It was final cut. We had a score. We just needed the sound mix. And I just couldn't get, and then, you know, it's just sort of, you look up and like 2 years have passed, and then, you know, your life sort of takes over on you, and it just became this thing. I just sort of fell in this depression about it, and I couldn't get it fixed. And then, like, my computer died, and I lost Final Cut 7, and I wasn't sure I was going to be able to even, like, revive it. And then it just became this thing in my head, you know?
So wait a minute. So it's kind of like The Shining, but you weren't in a lodge. But so you mean to tell me that then your computer failed, so you had no backups of the thing, and you couldn't get Final Cut 7 to work?
Yeah, I couldn't get Final Cut 7 back. And then it just became a thing where, like, I was afraid I had lost the film.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
and so, but I couldn't. It was a little bit of that, like, Schrodinger's cat, you know? Like, as long as I didn't know for sure that I had lost the film was not dead, you know? But the minute I was like, if I look, then it might be dead. And then I don't know what to do about that. And so it just, like, it just threw me into, like, this really deep funk creatively. And I just couldn't do anything. Like, I was just trapped by it. And it sounds really dumb in retrospect, but a lot of depression sounds really dumb in retrospect.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're just like, I just couldn't get out of bed. And you're like, how the fuck could you just not get out of bed? Like, just get out of bed.
Yeah. I mean, you know? From the outside looking in, I mean, when you're depressed, it's hard from somebody out looking in outside to understand what the depressed person is going through and what's triggering them inside. Cause I've been there. We've all been there and at certain at different levels as well. But,
I couldn't like face the idea of like having to tell everybody that the film was gone.
Wait, that's the thing I was going to tell you. Like, what did your actors think? Like, I mean, because actors are like, I'm waiting for this. One. Yeah, they had to have.
They had already gotten clips for the reels.
And that's all they cared about.
Probably all they cared about. Yeah. They were like, I think they just sort of stopped asking. And people would ask, and I just didn't know what to say. So would just sort of ignore it or change the subject.
So you literally spiraled.
I totally spiraled.
You spiraled and it kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper into this depression, and which kind of paralyzed you from moving forward.
Creatively. Yeah. And then like in that time I bought a house, I got married, I had a kid. So I was really busy.
Right.
So that was sort of the excuse, I guess.
Let me ask you a question. So because I've
but been, I couldn't write.
I've been there. Trust me. I haven't had a feature. I haven't gone through your steps, but I've gone through my own steps. Where your sister's this depression, how did your depression creatively affect the rest of your life? Because I know for me, I was an angry and bitter dude walking around when I couldn't get certain things done, or I was a year or two, you know, I wrote a whole book about my first experience, you know, making a movie for the mob that destroyed me for 3 years. Like I literally hid in a garage sorting comic books. Because I just was terrible. I didn't pick up a camera for 3 years after that. So I get it. So how did that affect the other
and
parts
so
of your
quickly,
life?
Like it becomes 3 years, like just like that.
Instantly you
you're
just
like,
look around
how,
and you're
how
like,
did that happen?
You're like, wait a minute, did a year just pass? Wait a minute, did two years just pass? And you get busy doing other things, but you know how did that affect the rest of your life? Because I mean, as a filmmaker and as an artist, it's a very big part of our existence.
Right.
So how did that affect the other parts of your life?
Well, I'm from New England, so I'm an angry and bitter dude anyway. So that's my starting point, you know?
That's your baseline.
That's baseline. So people didn't really notice. They're like, oh, he's just in a bad mood today. everything felt like, for a long stretch there, for probably 3 or 4 years, I was like, well, I guess I'm just done. I guess my film career is done. You know? It just felt like that to me. And I had sort of resigned myself to that fact. In a lot of ways, and I like really missed it, but I was just like, well, I guess I'll just pour this energy into other stuff. And so I got into running a lot, and I started organizing road races, which sort of felt like directing a movie. It's like the easiest directing of a movie you can possibly do. It's like if you're directing a movie, but like you stopped at lunch on the first day, that's directing a road race. Like, well, we're done. All right, great. There's no post-production. So, right. I mean, I was able to sort of channel the creative stuff into other places. I couldn't write. Like, it sort of blocked that part of my creative process. Like, I would try to write. Like, I tried to work on another script. And, like, my brain wouldn't let me do it. If that makes sense.
It makes all the sense in the world. And what I find fascinating, the concept of what you said, or what you just said, was the funneling that energy into other things where you... In many ways, and I'm talking about this from my point of view, you trick yourself into, you're like, well, I'm being creative. I'm doing other things, but they're not filmmaking. And maybe
I'm making something.
I'm building websites, or I'm running, or I'm working out, or I'm, you know.
Sorting comic books.
Yeah, sorting comic books. There's art here somewhere.
I've created the new Dewey Decimal System.
It's amazing. So you start funneling, and it's kind of like a hack just to survive. In so many ways, is that fair to say?
Yeah, because otherwise you're just gonna like spiral deeper into depression or alcoholism or both. Mm-hmm. And I already have alcoholism and depression, so I couldn't go any further into that. And I don't want to start doing drugs. So, you know, that's what you have to do, is you sort of have to figure out a hack, or you'll go insane and make the people around you miserable.
Yeah, and I'm so blessed that I've never drank. I've tried and I couldn't, mm-hmm. because I know I would be an alcoholic during
some
time.
It's very easy to do.
Oh my God, I literally tried and I couldn't. So I'm very glad that, because if not,
you're very lucky.
I'm very lucky in that sense, because I mean heroin, but who doesn't? But but joking aside, it's really interesting how you cope as a creative, especially as a filmmaker. When I can't even comprehend shooting a movie, editing the movie, and it being lost to you. Like
it was a terrifying idea.
It's the worst nightmare of any filmmaker, I think. Honestly.
Yeah, and it was hard to even think like how do you even come to grips with that? Like even wrapping your head around, what do you even do after that? You know, right. And then you start thinking like, well, maybe I can, like, if it's gone, maybe the files. I knew the files weren't all gone.
Right.
Like I knew worst case scenario, that the DP, Dustin Perlman, he had the original files in LA.
And you could rebuild the whole thing if you had to.
I could have, if I had to, I could rebuild the whole thing. But, oh my God.
Oh no. Oh my God. I'm
the
like,
thought of having to do that.
My anus is puckering. It's not my film. But I've had
I got a kid, a toddler. I don't have time to re-edit a film
And that's the thing too. Like as you get older, things that you put up with in your 20s, you're not putting up with in your 30s and 40s.
Oh yeah. If you're 22 and you say to someone, well, you just got to re-edit the whole film, they'd be like, okay.
All right, fine. I got nothing else going on.
Yeah.
I got nothing else to do. Why not? No, it's absolutely true. But I think there's so many times that we as filmmakers have to go through these rough patches. Mind you, your rough patch was it's an extreme. My rough patch was an extreme, I think that one of the things that you said, that like finding a hack, finding a way to funnel your energy out, because that energy still keeps coming.
Yeah,
it's there. Your need, your want, this I call it the sickness because once you get bit by that bug, it's over. Like you can't ever
it could you go can't just be a drone in a cubicle, like an office.
You can't
space.
Go. Yeah, you can't go work in Amazon's warehouse. Like you.
Yeah.
It's something inside you that can't stop you, and that's the artist thing. I've told people it can go dormant for decades, but it will always raise its head in one way, shape, or form. So I love the idea that finding that hack, finding something else that you can funnel that energy in. If this road is locked or closed to you right now, for whatever reason, you're focusing it on other things. And hopefully you can get that engine running enough that you can break through the barrier. How did you finally? How did you finally get through this, dude? Because it means 10 years.
Yeah. So oddly enough, it was the pandemic. So really? I didn't really get a pandemic break. Everybody else got a pandemic break, but I didn't really get one because I have a day job and my wife and I have a soap business, and so soap was very helpful and important during, especially the early days of the pandemic. So we were very busy. but I wasn't, I couldn't go anywhere. There were no races to run. There was nothing else to do. And so I finally was just like, you know what? And I was like, well, at minimum, probably everybody's home. So if I email everybody, they got nothing else going on right now. So
Right. No one else is busy.
No one else is busy. I'm busy, but nobody else is busy. And so I think the first thing I did was I emailed Dustin, and he's like, did this email get lost? When did you send this?
Like 7 years ago.
He's like, how slow is your email, man?
That's
and
funny.
So there were some jokes like that. And then, I got the full file from him for the picture. And then, And then I talked to the sound editor, and I've known the sound editor since college. So that was helpful in a way, in that I wasn't like, you know, he's an old friend of mine. And everyone was like, yeah, like Dustin found a copy of Final Cut 7 in LA. His girlfriend happened to have one on an old computer. And Dave, the sound editor, he was able to bring everything up on an old system and got everything transferred to the new system. And then just for like 8 or 9 months, we just sort of chipped away at it because we had more time to work with.
Nothing else to do.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, we got to get this done, man. He's like, yeah. He's like, I agree. This is like been, it had been looming in his head, sure. I think, too.
And everybody said.
Yeah, it was. In every, yeah. And so we finally got it. And I just want to say to any filmmakers listening, do not sound mix your film over email. Just do not do it. It's a terrible idea.
That's a horrible idea.
It takes forever because you're just making a list. You know, you're like, okay, so at 4 minutes and 13 seconds, can we bring this up a little? And then you're like, no, not that much.
No, no. Okay, okay. Find a happy medium. Like, oh yeah. Oh God,
that's brutal. it was such a pain in the ass. So, yes. Then we just sort of ended up getting it done over the course of like 2020. And finished it right before Christmas. And then I released it. I sent all of the backers on Christmas a Christmas present of the movie.
The backers.
And there was a lot of like, whoa, where did this come from? Like, because I kept it really quiet the whole time. Because I was like, first of all, I can't – if I go on Twitter and say, hey, guys, guess what? And this doesn't get finished.
You're done. You're done.
I'm just done. Like, I just shut it all down. I'm just going to log off of the internet forever. So I waited until it was like completed. And then just surprise Christmas present to all the Kickstarter backers, which was kind of fun.
That's, but, that, yeah. Can you imagine after 10 years, you get your reward?
Yeah. Your it was a lot of like, I just kept getting these emails like, whoa. Like, wow. Good for you, man. Like,
glad you so finally finished.
You think like in your head during this whole depression thing, you're like, oh, these people, like the Kickstarter backers are mad at you, and like, you know, 99% of them, they're like, I gave you $10, so you shoot, like, just the fact that you shot the film and
showed us something
yeah is enough. Like, that's, you know, I'm not really doing it for, you know, the film itself. I'm doing it for you, or because I like the idea or whatever.
Yeah.
So no one was mad. Like, they were all just, I think, really happy that it was done.
I got to ask you, what did the actors say?
The actors, they were pretty excited. They were, they were pretty psyched.
They're finally releasing a movie 10 years ago, so they look a little bit different.
They do look a little bit different. So.
God, there was a
movie.
It
has some good performances in it.
You want to hear, I'll do you one better as far as a movie that took so long to actually get out. There is a movie that exists about a killer grizzly bear that stars George Clooney, Charlie Sheen, and Laura Dern in the 80s.
Wow.
And it also had another actor. The guy from Indiana Jones, and from Lord of the Rings, the guy who played the Big Hobbit. But he was the guy with the... You know who I'm talking about, right? I forgot his name. Yeah. He's the Middle Eastern guy from Indiana Jones. He's like the good guy. He's like always helping Indy in all his films. And he's like the star of it at the time. And it never got released.
He's a big name.
And it never ever got released. And some, like, I was talking to somebody on the show and they're like, yeah, I was talking to Charlie. Yeah, I remember that. I had somebody who ran Charlie Sheen's production company for 3 years. And he goes, yeah, Charlie used to always tell me that he did a movie with George Clooney and Laura Dern that never got released. And we're like, what? And 20 years later, it's released. It's out there now. I think it's called The Killer Grizzly or something. Like, anyone listening, I'm sure it's fantastic. And they actually saw that trailer for it. The bear is, it's like a 15-foot bear. 20, it's like a 15, 20-foot, 30-foot bear. It's like an insane thing. But it looks so bad. It's 80s beauty.
Yeah.
Oh my God! So
they didn't try to like update the bear.
Not so much
CGI.
Not so much. But they did put the names of George Clooney, Charlie Sheen, and Laura Dern front and center on the poster.
The poster's a little different.
So don't feel too bad. There's other movies that have taken longer to finish.
Right.
Now, when you actually decided, because look, the pandemic helped all of us reevaluate our lives for better or worse.
It was kind of a perfect opportunity for that.
Yeah, because everybody, I mean, I did, everybody did, just like, what am I doing with my life? What, like, there's been so much of that. So when you finally just said, did you tell your wife? Did you just go like, I'm gonna finish the movie?
Yeah, well, she didn't know me when the movie was like, when we made it.
It was mythical. So, it was a mythical thing.
It's like, yeah, sure, okay, I bet, yeah, okay, you're a filmmaker, sure. Whatever, man. Yeah, I was like, I sort of told her, and she's like, okay. And then I don't think, she didn't watch it until it was done.
Right.
And then she's like, oh, that was better than I thought it was going to be.
It's kind of like what my wife says, too, when she watches my movies. She's like, not bad. She's not in the business, so that's why.
Yeah.
That's like, that's not bad. Pretty good. So when you finally broke through and you said, hell with it, I'm going to finish this, and you go through this laborious task of rebuilding, did you have to rebuild it, or you were able to?
No, I didn't have to rebuild it.
You brought it back up. You brought it back up through Final Cut.
We were able to revive it.
Okay, so you brought it back up.
The paddles and were clear.
Man, but, you know, the thing is that
it took some doing to revive it. But no, it wasn't just as simple as opening the file.
No, because, I mean, I was a Final Cut 7 holdout for a long time. And some of my I think my first feature was done. No, my first, my other features were done in Resolve, but all my shorts and all the big stuff I did before were all Final Cut 7. So I have Final Cut 7 projects that I couldn't rebuild if I tried. Like, I'd have to, like, literally, oh my God, it'd be immense. But it scares me to even think about that. I would honestly just do a cut by cut redo. Like, I would take the rough cut. Or the cut, and then just match cut it.
I could have probably done that too.
I would have just done that.
But and I would have just ended up changing everything. I didn't know I would have.
It
took me like another year.
Oh, Jesus Christ. But so, all right. So it took you 10 years to get to this point. Were there ever you went down the road and you're like, screw it, I'm out. I can't do this.
Not really. There were a couple. There were some days where I sort of looked at the drive, and you know, sort of stared it down like in a Clint Eastwood movie.
But I gotta ask. Okay, so did it just become a boogeyman for you at this point?
Yeah. It was definitely that. It was just this thing that was like looming. It was like this massive thing on my to-do list that I couldn't.
I'm digging into this because I want people to hear and understand how paralyzing that is.
Yeah.
Like, for me, it was writing the book about that horrible time almost making a movie for the mob. Like, it took me forever because I didn't want to go back there.
Yeah.
It's just like this whole, like, and I would just stare at the notes and the piles of research that I laid out. Just like, I don't want to go back there. And it's paralyzing. And it took me 17 years to write that book.
Wow.
Because I didn't want to go back there. I just.
Yeah.
I literally didn't want to go back there. It takes
like so much energy to any part of this process. And so to think that any of it was lost is just like, it's just hard to like process.
You can't process it at all. So you got it done. You put it out? Did it get distributed?
Right now we're waiting to, we're trying to get into a festival.
Okay.
I like owe everybody like an actual festival run. So, the least I can do.
At least
a festival run. And then, I mean, it's a $4,000 Kickstarter movie, so it's not exactly going to get picked up by A24. I don't have any delusions of grandeur about that. But I mean, if they want to email me, then that's great.
If A24 is listening, I'm open.
I'm easy to find. Yeah, so we'll do the festival run, and then I assume I'll end up self-distributing it and, VOD it, and probably it'll end up on Prime and all the other places.
Yeah, I mean, it's a $4,000 feature.
$4,000 Kickstarter movie. Yeah, it's in the black still. So,
well, I mean,
I think it is like $4 left in the budget, something like that. And so every time I submit to a festival, I go, hey, I do the waiver thing, you know, I try to get the waiver, and they're like, oh, we don't do waivers. I'm like, I got $4 left in the budget of this movie, man. I'm not going.
And
into
it
the
took
red
me 10 point. Years to yeah. make it. Can you,
yeah,
can you
there's no, I'm not going into the red for this.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Not for your film festival, just because you haven't figured out a good model to stay in business, and you need my submission fees to stay, you know, pay for your Stella Artois.
Yeah.
You know, that's your problem.
That's not my problem.
It's not my problem, man.
So, once you broke through this dam, did you mm-hmm. finally, the creative juices start flowing again?
Yeah, I wrote a script pretty quickly. I wrote a script about the pandemic, actually, but it's not like a Zoom movie. It's not. It's
please
actually.
Please don't do that.
Yeah,
don't,
no, God. No, it was actually an idea I came up with probably 9 years ago. It was this idea I came up with, and I couldn't ever figure out how to crack it. And the pandemic actually solved like three plot problems. And I was like, oh, it works now. This is great. And it's sort of like, so it's one of those movies where like the pandemic's in the background mm-hmm. and it just sort of cleans up some stuff. But like stuff that like would prevent the movie from making sense, where you'd be like 2 minutes in, you go, wait a minute, this doesn't work. Right. So I wrote that, and then I was trying to get that made. And then I sort of, it's like a road trip movie, and I was like, I don't know that I really want to be driving across the country right now with a production crew. Mm-hmm. Seems like a bad idea. So then I wrote Maine Noir, which I wrote in like 19 days. Nice. And we just crowdfunded that.
Yeah.
So like it came back really quickly. It was like, it was like the dam broke, you know?
And all of that, and you were stagnant for almost a decade. Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? It's a weird.
It's like hard to even like looking back on it, it just seems insane. Yeah. It's kind of the best way to.
It doesn't
not
seem
to
real.
Diminish mental health or anything, but it just is crazy.
It doesn't even seem that it was 10 years. It doesn't even seem that was a real. It seems like a dream almost.
Yeah. Yeah, the only real like change is that I have a lot more gray hair than I did.
A few things hurt more than they used to.
Yeah, yeah, I'm a lot more sore.
More pains, more aches.
Yeah.
Does anything hurt when it rains?
A lot. Yeah, a lot of things actually.
Oh God, isn't getting older fun?
It's such a hassle. Don't do it. If you're out there, 25-year-old filmmakers, don't do it.
It's don't get older. It. It's not worth it. Don't get older. It's great. Someone
your writing gets better, but other than that, it's not worth it.
I mean, there's a few other things about good or about getting older, but generally speaking, the physical part it can take the whole as they say
running helps. I can recommend that.
Youth is wasted on the young. That's
it is. Yeah, I just watched my 4-year-old. And he just falls asleep at like weird angles, and I'm like. How can you move the next day?
Jesus, they bounce. Mine just drop and fall and like they watch TV on their neck, like upside down on a chair. And I'm like, what is wrong with you?
How is that possible?
It's insanity. Yeah. Now you and your new film Maine Noir, you mm-hmm. crowdfunded that, and from what I saw, it was pretty successful.
Yeah, we raised $46,000 on Seed and Spark.
Nice.
For it. So yeah, that was I was listening to this came from part of the where this came from was I was listening to Dan Mervish on a podcast, and because I have my podcast rule is like I subscribe to like 10 podcasts, like I subscribe to yours and like a couple other ones, so I was listening to him and he was like talking about how just like this idea of like picking a start date and just sort of pushing towards that date and sort of building the parachute as you jump out of the plane. And so that's kind of what we did. And so I started writing the script and I was just like, okay, we'll shoot this in this window. We're actually not going to shoot it in that window because what happened was the crowdfunding campaign was so successful that everyone sort of like at the end of it, we went, wait, okay, so we can rush and we can shoot this in this very, very tight window here. that we have in the fall.
Yeah.
Or we could do another pass of the script and do a real pre-production and shoot it in the spring. Because no one wants to shoot in Maine in the winter for some reason. I don't know why.
It's very pleasant.
All these LA people are like, we don't really want to come to Maine in the winter necessarily. And I'm like, why? I don't understand why.
I always say that on the show. Like, if you want to pitch to an actor, go, okay, we need you in the winter in Buffalo. Or Hawaii. Which one would you rather go to?
Yeah, part of our pitch was, well, you get to come to Maine when it's nice. And they're like, oh, that sounds fun. Yeah. Yes, we're gonna shoot it in the spring now, and
that's beautiful in the spring. Maine is. I've been to Rockport a lot.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's right down the road.
Yeah, it's during the spring and summer is stunning there. People will go in the spring and summer like, this is fantastic. This is heaven. We should move here. And then the winter shows up.
You would not believe how many people abandoned New York City and Boston for houses they bought in Maine during the pandemic. And the rest of us we're all just sitting there going, man, just wait for the winter, man. Oh, I can't wait for you to go through this winter.
It's like going to Toronto, like, you know, or Vancouver. You're like, oh, this is beautiful. Oh, my God. And then 10 nature hits. So it was a very successful campaign. Can you actually do a little bit of campaign, crowdfunding campaign counseling or consulting?
Yeah, I used to do it a lot and I don't really do it anymore.
When you did, going back 10 years, the crowdfunding game has changed a bit since.
A little bit.
Since
it hasn't, because it's still the same idea. It's the same general principle of you're trying to convince somebody to give you money for an idea you have.
Right.
So all of those concepts are the same. I think the biggest change is that people, you don't have to explain it to them, really.
As much, yeah.
Because when I first started, you're like, okay, so there's a website called Kickstarter. .com and you're going to go there.
All right,
you're not going to get your money back. Right. You're not investing in this movie.
You're just giving money.
You're giving them money. They are giving you the promise of something, like a t-shirt or a DVD or a high five or something. You know, and so you don't have to do that anymore. But so that helps grease the wheels, but the downside is that the algorithms on all the social media networks are terrible now, especially for something like that. So it's a lot harder to make a noise.
How did you make noise with it? Because 46,000 is a substantial amount for an independent film with no stars attached. And arguably you haven't been outputting a lot in the last decade. So
true. Everybody's got their money saved up.
Exactly. They're all waiting for Lucas to go.
There was a little bit of that, you know, there was a little bit of the, new Lucas McNally film. Hell yeah, I'm in. It's like the really terrible version of like when there was that big gap in Terrence Malick's career and everyone was very excited for that first Malick film in like 30 years or whatever it was, like the really terrible version of that.
Right.
So then the next one, everybody was like, so it's just, I made a noise by kind of doing, well, the reason I stopped consulting is that I got tired of people not doing what I told them to do.
Shocking.
And then the campaign failing, you know, and they're like, why isn't it working? I'm like, well, because you didn't do any of the things that I told you to do. So it's not working. So if you do them, it'll work. So I just did all those things. And so that worked out pretty well.
So all the things I tell people to do, I did, and it worked.
And look at that. Who knew? You know, it's just basic guerrilla marketing stuff. It was thanking people. And we made I made a surprise perk where, because the movie's about a woman who finds money hidden in her house. And so the surprise perk was that I would, if I could find a picture of you quickly, this is why I didn't make it an actual perk, because sometimes you can't find pictures of people. I fake $100 bill that had the website that you go to back the campaign. It would had mainnoir.com on it instead of the Federal Reserve thing. Mm-hmm. And then I would just email you this picture of your face on a bloody $100 bill. And people were like, oh my gosh, that's great. And so then when you send them that, they're like, I'm going to post this on Facebook now. So you're able to break through the algorithm that way. Thanking people is a good way to do it. You know, you're like, so one of my favorite crowdfunding moves is I had this long thread on Twitter and it would be like, backer number 55 is so-and-so. And then I would tag them and I would be like, so-and-so directed this film, or they run a bakery, or they do a thing. And you just take like 30 seconds to like research this person, which is just the polite thing to do if they're going to give you money, is to like figure out who they are. And sometimes you learn cool things like, oh my gosh, this person won 3 games of Jeopardy. That's so cool. And then you just say something about them to say, you know, this is how cool they are. Thank you. And then you have a link to the campaign. And so then people retweet that, because you're thanking them and you took 10 seconds to learn something about them instead of just taking the money and moving on to the next person. And those are kind of the two easiest ways to do it.
That breaks through the algorithm, because the algorithm it's so bad.
It can't break through the algorithm, yeah. And then I made like a little 30-second video that had the premise of the movie, and I had that on Twitter, and I would just kept encouraging people to retweet that, because the more retweets something gets, the like more Twitter's algorithm is going to amplify it anyway. And so that got retweeted like 80 something times, and that helped a lot. And then in order to keep it, I wanted to avoid the campaign being all like, give me money, give me money, give me money. So I recruited a bunch of like film writers to make mm-hmm. videos about what their favorite thing about film noir is. Mm-hmm. And because I wanted to sort of celebrate those old 40s noirs, those really cool, yeah, like dingy, dirty ones, you know? And so I got like Matt Zoller-Seitz and Odie Henderson and people like that. And they would make these cool videos about like, I love the dialogue and the classy dames and all that, and they would shoot it in black and white, and then we would post those, and that would help get the word out. So it's sort of a multi-prong attack.
Yeah,
and then eventually, if you're persistent enough, the idea I think isn't to necessarily get people to on the first try. Mm-hmm. Like it has to become sort of an inevitability where they're just like, okay, I've been watching this campaign for 15 days. Okay, I'm in. Finally, you got me. You won me over. And that sometimes that's what it takes. And yeah, you're always gonna think people are tired of listening to you, but they usually aren't.
Yeah, and the thing is with the algorithms, man, Facebook is just horrible.
It's terrible.
Man. They are. You put a link to anything now, like, you know, I've got almost 250,000 followers, and I get like 150 people. Post. It's insanity.
So one thing I did to work around that is I had mainnoir.com, and that would redirect directly to the, it would go directly to the campaign. So I would put that in images. So you would see the URL, but the algorithm wouldn't recognize it as a URL. And it was, you know, because it would just be like,
it's an image.
Image.
It wasn't a link.
Right. And it was enough. It was a short enough URL that you would remember it. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I said to you then, like, "Oh, what was the URL?" You would go, "Oh, I think it's it's main noir." Yeah, yeah. And it's not something weird like bit.ly dot, whatever.
Right.
You know, that sort of helped.
As a redirecting, you just redirected it using that URL.
Yeah.
Smart.
And then I can just turn that into the website for the film when the film's
finished. Now, what is I have to ask you, how do you correctly budget a crowdfunding campaign? Because that's a whole other beast.
It's a whole thing. I had only one perk that cost money to deliver.
Interesting.
And that was the DVD perk at $100. And the rest of them were all digital. So those don't have a cost. And so I just knew my $100 one, all I had to do was deliver a DVD. And I'm like, well, I know a DVD is not going to cost that much to make. We're talking like $3 or $4.
Right.
You know, if I'm buying them in bulk. So I'm like, well, that's plenty of a margin there.
Right.
And then just budgeting. And then it's just budgeting the film. And even then I didn't have my cast or anything. So I just sort of was kind of guessing and playing that game of how much do I think I can raise? Can I get the film in the can for this amount? And they were just sort of moving numbers around and sort of zeroing in on that.
And did you,
I guess we'll try 45.
So was it 45 was the goal?
Was the goal, yeah.
45. And did you?
We hit it on the last day.
Did you like? You know, you've worked with Kickstarter and Seed and Spark. Which one are you that I work with?
I think they both have good qualities. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on what you need, I think, as to which one you want. I had done both of them, And I wanted to use Seed and Spark for this one because they have the follower system, mm-hmm. where you can follow a campaign and not necessarily back it. And then if you get enough followers, there's some like swag you can unlock, mm-hmm. like discounts on DCPs and like film festival submissions. And I was like, okay, I really want to get to that 500 follower level to unlock all that stuff. So that's why I went with Seed and Spark on
that
this
makes
one.
Sense. That makes sense. And, what is, in your opinion, what's the biggest mistake that filmmakers make when they go after crowdfunding? Because I crowdfunded my first feature, mm-hmm. and I promised I would never do it again because it's such a brutal process. It was great, and we financed it, and it was awesome, and we were in the black, and I gave me a ton of freedom to do whatever the hell I wanted. But that 30 days.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's lovely, but that 30 days was just brutal.
I think the biggest mistake is people don't plan enough. You know, like you've got to have, I was talking, Sean Hackett helped me out a lot with this one. And he was telling, you know, he's got like this massive spreadsheet with a plan. And I'm like, I got all that in my head because I've done enough of these. And he's like, you're a little insane. I'm like, well, I've done enough of these that I know how the rhythm of the campaign is going to go. So for someone like me, I can sort of fly by the seat of my pants just from experience, but you really want to have a plan. You got to have a plan for the middle 2 weeks. You know, the first week you're going to start with a bang. And then if you're going to get, you know, if you can get there at the end, the rally will be good. But it's really those middle 2 weeks and having something for there. And so that's where I had the noir videos. And then also since we are filming it in my hometown, I shot a bunch of videos of myself around town, like telling people from LA mostly, I guess, like, this is this cool thing in this town that you've never heard of that. And then that did really well to actually activate the locals and get the local audience involved. And so it was just a question of building the base. But yeah, I think the biggest mistake is people don't plan enough. And then they go in scared. You know, it's like, if you're playing poker and you're afraid to lose, then you're going to lose. You know, you got to go in like you have not a care in the world. You got to play like, you know, you got to play bold, and you can't go in thinking people are tired of listening to you, right. or they don't care, or that you're bothering them. So the story I always tell people is my first feature, we played it. We got it booked in a theater here. This is when I was living in Pennsylvania, and we got it booked in a theater here for a week. And I was like, so psyched. So I came home for like a month ahead of time, and I just promoted the hell out of it. Like, more than you would promote a crowdfunding campaign. Like, I was on the radio. I was putting up flyers. I was pestering the hell out of everybody. Cause I was like, I wanted to sell out the theater at least the opening night of the week. And so the second night we got a really good crowd, and we were like the second highest grossing movie there that week or something at the multiplex. So the second day, this friend of mine shows up for like the matinee. And this is a guy who like, I've known since I was like 7. Like, when I would come home for Christmas, we would hang out. I would watch football games at his house. You know, this is the guy I didn't think I really needed to tell about it, because I just figured he knew. And I'm like, hey, you came to see my movie. He's like, what movie? I'm like, you're not here to see my movie? He's like, you made a movie? I'm like, what do you mean? Yes, I made a movie. Where have you been? He's like, I'm here to see the Ridley Scott movie. I'm like, you son of a bitch. And that's sort of the lesson to me of like, you're never promoting it as much as you think you are, because people have their own lives. You know, they've got their own stuff going on. He had his own things. He completely missed it. Like, one of my inner circle people, he completely missed that I was even in town. He didn't even know I was home.
That's funny, man. That is funny.
So, you know, you just keep talking about it, and people are, you know, sometimes they're just watching, and they're, you know, usually going, all right, as long as you're not annoying, as long as you're not being a pest, you know, make it fun.
Now, I'm going to ask
make
you.
Make it engaging.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now, I wanted to ask you.
You know, not just give me money, give me money.
Yeah. Yelling and screaming and broadcasting, like, give me money, give me money, give me money. It's the wrong approach to anything. In general.
Yeah. Nobody likes it.
Now, over these last 10 years, man, what is the biggest lesson you took from that time?
I mean, the obvious one is like, don't give up, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
keep a computer, an old computer running Final Cut 7 if at all possible.
At all times. That's just good valuable advice for everybody.
Good advice. You got to have Final Cut 7. You take it to your grave, man. It's so valuable. It's such a good editing system. Why they went to X, I don't know. Terrible idea. Nobody's paying as much attention to your shit as you are. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you think that you're bothering everybody or that you know, everybody's mad at you or whatever, or they're tired of you. And they're usually not. I mean, they might be. There's some people that we're all tired of, mm-hmm. but they're usually not, because they've got their own lives and they're doing their own stuff. And you are just a supporting player in their movie. You know, they don't see your movie over here where you're the star, one man show, doing all your stuff, you know, like. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I know that you have a website and you have your Indie Film Hustle stuff and all that stuff. And I don't watch all of it. Mm-hmm. I watch some of it. Like, mm-hmm. like I said, if you have a guest on, someone I know, I'm like, oh, and I'll dip into your world mm-hmm. for an hour. And then I won't think about you again for like 2 weeks until I see your name pop up somewhere. And I go, oh, hey, it's Alex. And then I won't think about you again for another 2 or 3 weeks. It's just how it works. I'm not sitting here going, man, I wonder what Alex is doing right now. Because that would be weird.
That would be awkward, sir. But no, it's so true. Yeah. And by the way, that's also very true, because even people that I follow and listen to their podcasts and things like that, I'm not there every week. I just got too much stuff going on. So either they'll come up on my screen and I'll be like, oh, they're doing that. And then maybe when I dip back into that world, I'm like, well, you know, what else have they been doing for the last three weeks, 4 weeks, a month or two? And then I'm like, oh, that's another episode I got to listen to. And you kind of dive into it, and then you get what you need, and then you kind of go away and
go on with your day.
Right. And there's other people who are just, you know, that just like, oh, my God, there's so much information. I have to just absorb all of it all the time. And that's fine, too, because I've done that as well. I've gone into, especially when I'm learning about something new.
You go down that rabbit hole.
I go down deep into that rabbit hole. So it's all fair. But it's a good analogy. You're right. Everyone's not thinking about your movie that didn't get made 10 years ago.
Right. They've completely forgotten about it.
As you sending them DVDs showed, like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a completely different form of depressing idea, because they're just like, oh, right, that movie. And it's like such an albatross in your whole life. And people are like, I totally forgot you did that.
Well, I don't know.
And then I gave you money for it.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but filmmakers tend to have egos. I'm just saying some think that the world revolves around them. I'm not saying everybody. I'm saying some.
I bet on those sets.
It's like... You would hear some directors talk and you're like, so you're curing cancer, are you? Oh, I wasn't aware that we were doing that here today. I thought we were shooting a commercial.
You know what the difference is between God and a cinematographer?
Oh God, what is it?
God doesn't think he's a cinematographer.
That's right. That's right. Oh my God. And let me ask you, man, three of your favorite films of all time.
Of all time. Boy, that's a hard one. Okay, so I'm a big basketball person, so Hoosiers.
That's for me, like,
Hoosiers was the movie that, like, when my brother and I were sick and stayed home from school, they would go rent. My parents would go rent Hoosiers mm-hmm. at the video store when those were a thing. So Hoosiers, for sure. Probably, it's, like, such a big difference between favorite and, like, ones I think are the best, because, like, you know, like, I'm probably not going to watch Decalogue too many more times.
Probably not.
You know, probably. But maybe like The Godfather. Mm-hmm.
There's movies you can respect. You're like, I've seen it once or twice and it's amazing, but I'm not going to just sit there and veg on it. Like Decalogue, you can't just, it's not a passive thing. Like, you know,
you're not going to be like, let me put in scenes from Marriage.
You can... You can watch Armageddon and The Rock 1,000 times.
Yeah. So maybe Swingers would probably be the third one then.
There you go. Swingers. Yeah. Because I could watch Swingers, put it in, yeah. And you're just like, oh.
We watched that. That was like in college, I think.
And John Favreau's done okay for himself, I think, after that. He made a couple movies and he's doing okay now.
Yeah. I mean, he did okay.
He's doing all right now. I hear he's directing.
Good
now.
For him.
Good for him. I'm so glad. And he's done good.
Quick plug for Maid, because Maid
is the
underrated masterpiece of Jon Favreau's career.
Yes, and I love Maid.
My favorite thing about Maid is that Vince Vaughn is playing a guy who thinks he's the guy in Swingers, but is not.
Well, Vince Vaughn. That's
my favorite thing about Maid.
Well, I mean, Vince Vaughn plays the guy from Swingers pretty much his entire career. I mean, it's very rare.
And that's the movie where he plays the guy who thinks he's that guy, but has none of those skills at all.
That's amazing.
It's such a great performance.
And Vince has moved on, but he does play the Vince. He plays Vince Vaughn very well.
I mean, that's how you become a movie star, is you play that type.
Oh, it's like Tom.
Work for Jimmy Stewart.
I mean, look, Tom Cruise. I love that movie where Tom Cruise is a young, cocky, white guy.
Yeah. That's my favorite one.
I mean, I can't pick. There's just so many. But yeah, I love when he plays those characters. and let's give a shout out to Chef, because Chef is the other unsung hero of John Favreau's filmography, because I can watch Chef again and again. I can watch it again. And at the beginning of the movie, if anyone's watching, it's on Netflix right now. You watch the first 10 minutes as he destroys a food critic, which is very thinly veiled as all the bull crap that he's been dealing with from film critics all his career. And he goes off, and it is wonderful to watch.
Which is weird to me, because film critics have always really liked him.
Apparently some didn't.
That's the thing. Like, you know, you get those like 100 good reviews and you get that one bad review, and you're David thing where you're like, oh, that's
But that's the case with filmmakers. I mean, I love Ridley, because Ridley Scott, he's just like, I haven't read a review since Alien. Like, he just doesn't.
That's probably the way to do it.
And he just do you and just keep going and keep going. He just doesn't care. Yeah. Doesn't care to read, because it's useless. It really is useless to read.
Yeah. Stuff. I mean, I think I was submitting to a film festival and they're like, do you want feedback? I'm like, no, I don't want feedback. I don't.
From you?
I know what's wrong with the movie. I know what's wrong with the movie more than you do.
Just like, am I playing in your festival or am I not? That's the end of our conversation.
I don't care what your one reviewer who already reviewed the movie on Letterboxd thinks about the movie. I don't care. I'm not one of those filmmakers who thinks that like the movie I made is the greatest gift to cinema since the Lumiere brothers. Like, I'm not one of those guys. I'm like the biggest, no one hates my movie more than me, I promise you. Like, well, I mean, know every single thing that's wrong with it.
Well, don't forget, Scorsese said it right, where he says, like, if you don't think your movie's an absolute disaster after watching the first cut, you've done something wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that valley where you're like, they're never going to let me make another movie. They're never going to let me. And then, like, oh, it kind of works.
It's coming together.
If you can get to it kind of works, then you've got a hit on your hand.
It kind of works, exactly.
Let me ask you this. Can you watch your movie with an audience?
Yes.
Because I can't.
The last time I saw it fully, without just skipping through it, in a theater, I just died laughing. Because I look at it completely as a viewer looking at ridiculous filmmakers trying to sell their movie at Sundance. So I just laugh, because I laugh at the stories, because I was there, how they made it, and, and what we came up with and what we had to. So for me, for that movie, I can't. For my first movie, I can't. I really just rather not. I can't do it at all. This last movie is one of those weird things. But even all my other movies I've done, I've been able to watch them, and I've enjoyed watching them with audiences. But it's not particularly something. I don't sit there and watch my movies all the time. I'm good. Like, I don't need to see them again.
Yeah, I'm good and I don't need to see it. And then, but it's just like I overreact in my head to all the everyone's reactions, even if they're not actually reacting. You know, like someone gets up to go to the bathroom and I'm like, oh my God, it's a walkout.
I'll tell you what, I was lucky enough. here in Austin to go to the 30th anniversary of Slacker with Rick.
Oh, cool.
With Richard Linklater. So when I asked him, I'm like, when was the last time you saw this? He's like, since the 20th anniversary. Like, I haven't sat and watched it since then. And yeah. you really shouldn't. I don't think Coppola is sitting around watching Godfather. Like, unless he's remastering it. He's remastering it. And then we'll leave on this. Can we all just give a big shout out to Mr. Francis Ford Coppola for dumping $100 million of his wine money into making epic movie that he wants to make, and he doesn't give a F about whatever is happening. It's amazing.
I wish I could have like pulled him aside before I did that and be like, dude, crowdfund it.
Oh, no, he's going to be okay. He's going to be fine.
He'll be all right. He'll be all right. But how – that would have been the easiest sell of a Kickstarter campaign ever.
But you have to – well, of course. No, and everybody would want to – oh, no, it's easy. Yeah. I'd throw money in. Of course, everybody would throw money in.
He'd be funded and like – he'd have like $80 million in like 4 days.
But the problem is that, you know, everybody knows that he's richer than whatever now because of his wine.
That's true.
It's so funny that at 82 is how old he's 82 years old. He's still going thinking for it. He's not just thinking about it. He's doing something so unprecedented that no one else has done in the history of cinema. No one has gone into their pocket. Spielberg hasn't gone to his pocket other than Schindler's List.
Yeah.
When he dumped out $30 million.
Spielberg's got $100 million like in the couch.
Exactly. To go make a movie that he wants to make at 82.
Yeah.
That's the insanity of filmmakers. That is how insane we all are.
Imagine how sore he is in the morning.
And he hasn't made a movie. He hasn't made a movie in at least a decade, I think. When was the last one?
He was doing
a lot of little independents.
He did some small things.
He did some small little independent things. He was just kind of playing around, but he hasn't like shot anything for a while. And now he's just, when I saw that, my heart filled with joy. And I said, we need guys like that out there and directors out there taking huge swings, huge, monstrous swings. And that's the biggest swing
you can take.
Yeah. And that's a big one because he's like, no studio is going to finance this. So I'm going to finance it myself because I got mad wine money.
I feel like someone would have. I'm like just amazed that like Amazon didn't finance it or somebody. I'm just amazed. Like there's so much money in streaming. It might make it.
There's Netflix or somebody might come in and fill in the gap. But he came out and said, like, "Look, I'm looking for money. But if you guys don't give me money, somebody doesn't give me money, I'm just gonna. I don't want to, but I'll do it because I gotta do this and the story he wants to tell about." It's for the next generation. I'm like, you got. I hope
it's
I can get
him. He'll own it outright. He'll have all the. I just. You know, hope, he won't even tell him what to do.
I hope I can get him on the show one day just to have the conversation with him. I'm like, Francis, thank you.
That would be one you would listen to, right?
Like you would pop. So you would pop back in.
I don't know him, but I would make an exception for that one.
I occasionally have those kind of people on the show that you're like, yeah. Oh, okay.
Oh. All right, yeah.
I'm going to listen to that conversation.
They're cool. They seem nice.
Lucas, man, it's been a pleasure for having you on the show, man. And thank you so much for being so raw and honest and about your experience with depression as a filmmaker, because I think it's something that we all go through, but no one talks about it. No one wants to talk about this.
No one wants to admit it, because the minute you say, oh, I have depression issues, who's going to like let you direct a movie?
Well, first of all, anybody out there who gives power to somebody else or gives the ability to – we're all depressed. All directors are – every single one of them have some sort of depression. Even, you know, did you watch the Scorsese, the short film he shot during pandemic when he was
laughing? Oh, no, I haven't watched that yet.
Oh, my God. It's so good. It's like this trippy, depressive – he was so depressed because he couldn't direct. He couldn't do anything. He was locked in.
He's one of those guys who's been going 100 miles an hour for 50 years or whatever.
Yeah, since the 70s. He just doesn't stop. He just like boom, 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 boom. And all of a sudden just, I can't go anywhere. So he grabbed an iPhone and started shooting.
Yeah, that would really throw you.
Yeah, no question. But Lucas, man, thanks again for being on the show, and I wish you nothing but the best with your new film. Let's try to finish this one before 2034.
I'll work what I can do. Do my best.
Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it, brother.
As long as they don't change the editing software on me, then I'll be fine.
Oh, Jesus. God, no, software's not changing often. So you'll be fine, yeah. I think.
I want to thank Lucas so much for coming on the show and sharing his journey with us. Thank you so much, Lucas. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/510.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.